Hey, today on Shift and Stare, we've got everybody in the house, and we have a guest, Ariel Adams from A Blog to Watch. That's right. If we don't run out of time, we're going to tell you all about how cars and watches, they just go like that, man. They mesh because car guys like watches. And I think we're also going to talk about, what, some disappearing Hellcats, you guys?
Yeah, a little bit of joyriding, I think. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. There's some stories to be told today on Shift and Steer.
That's right. So let's get rolling. Who's bringing this opportunity for everybody to watch, Matt?
Oh, our friends at Geico, as always.
Oh, I was going to read that one.
You're going to read that ad. But
I'll read it.
We don't want Geico.
Nowhere apart these days, we're sharing more. And Geico would just like to say thanks. Thanks for sharing your savage dance moves. Thanks for sharing your DIY haircut fails. Thanks for sharing your inner lip sync star. Now it's Geico's turn to share too, with the Geico Give Back, a 15% credit on car and motorcycle policies for current and new customers. And because Geico's committed for the long haul, the 15% credit lasts your entire full policy term. Visit geico.com/giveback for info and eligibility. I don't think you guys are eligible.
Nope, not eligible.
Yeah, you are. Everybody is. Sure. All right, let's get the show rolling, man.
Who writes this stuff?
The Adam Carolla Show is going on the road. Next stop, Nashville, Tennessee. Clay Travis is joining me on Friday, and Podcast One's Caitlin Bristow from Off the Vine is going to be joining me as well for a Saturday show. And we're doing a special live stream. If you want to watch the pod and be part of the action, check out livexlive.com and get the Live by Live app. It's all happening this weekend, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific. My Houston show had over 1 million views, and I'd be stoked if this one could surpass that number so we can do that with you. So it's going to be a great show. Make sure you tune in this Saturday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific. Check out livexlive.com or download the Live by Live app.
Racing, rides, people, and places. With your hosts, Brad Vanshore, Matt DeAndrea, and Aaron Hagar. New media for a new type of motorsport enthusiast.
Good to see you guys.
Hey!
Back. You're all safe. You're all sound.
Yeah.
I know Matt said that he has National Guard sitting outside, but that's your private security, isn't it?
Yeah, I brought them in. I brought them in to make sure the podcast goes well.
Good.
Well, yeah, because Matt's really controversial these days.
I want to keep this this week, guys. I think we've all talked about it. We want to keep it on a light note, you know, more about cars and not about the turmoil, because I think there's definitely enough press about that going on. But there are a couple of things that have been happening that are kind of related, I guess you would say. And but before we do that, I do want to remind everybody, because we usually do this at the end of the show, but you guys have been really helping us out, and I want to thank you, and I want to make sure that you keep doing it. Jump on the bandwagon, guys. Go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and leave a comment. We've gotten a bunch of them lately, and we appreciate that, but it really does help us. That's what helps us. And when you like our social media, our Facebook page, when you like our Instagram, all that, because when people, believe it or not, when potential advertisers look at it and they see big numbers there, they go, those guys are influencers. Now, you know we're not. But between us, okay?
I can't even influence my kids. What the hell are you talking about?
But anyways, I think a lot of people, if you haven't seen it by now or heard about it, we're going to tell you about it, because up in San Leonardo, which is up in the Bay Area. Could you believe that? 50 cars stolen from a single Dodge dealership?
Yeah.
Dodge is on fire right now.
When the guy calls into corporate headquarters, he goes, we got rid of 50 units. Most of them were Hellcats and $100,000 cars. They're going, oh, my God, that's great. Your numbers are off the charts. Because, yeah, but we don't have any paperwork on it.
Yeah.
Do we know the breakdown of what cars were taken? Obviously, they were trying to just loot some hot rods. And, you know, I know they took Hellcats and Red Eyes and whatever they can get a hold of. But I don't think they had 50 Hellcats, right?
I don't know, but I just read an article this morning to kind of get familiar with it. And it said the majority were Hellcats and performance Dodge vehicles. And there were still others sitting there. When you see the video from Channel 7 mm-hmm. up in the Bay Area, where, like, this was like gone in 60 seconds.
Yeah, totally. I mean,
they took one, started it up, and did you guys see where it, like, they pushed two other cars? There's black marks on the floor. They just pushed between two other cars and then right out the front doors, the glass doors. I mean,
At first
I heard it, I thought, this is a professional group of thieves trying to take advantage. Then when I saw the carnage, I was like, this was just a bunch of guys that got in there.
It was planned. I'm sure it was planned. And they maybe even went by ahead of time and kind of figured out what's what and how they're going to get out. But I think they brought a bunch of people. They all had a plan. They all grabbed cars, found a way to get them all started, did whatever. Obviously, they've stolen cars before.
Well, they said they found the key safe. So that tells me maybe somebody that worked there said, well, the key safe's in Bob's office or something
Again,
like that.
Somebody went and kind of scoped it out and figured it out. And how long do you think they all sit around, like, with the numbers on the keys going, which car is this? And hitting the button. Exactly. And then, oh, you take that one.
It was probably...
just hitting the buttons, and taking them out and kind of wrecking them and joyriding. I'm like, there was no intent on like stealing them and selling them or parting them out. It was just carnage. It was just
joyriding carnage.
When I first heard it, I thought, wow, those things are already in containers, headed down south or headed to the Middle East or something. But then when you saw, there was actually footage of a guy in one of them doing burnouts in an intersection, you know, and, it, you know, doing donuts. And it was like, okay, these guys. And right across the street, there was a Nike store. Oh, my God, I've never seen a store so just wiped out. I mean, it was like even the fixtures were gone. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, when you look at the aftermath of some of the stores that were hit, not just the cars, but just from the looters, it really is a mess, and it's terrible. But I'm wondering how that dealer had so many of those cars. I thought they were still doing pretty well.
Fleet dealership, right? So they're like a hub for all the other dealers. Everything gets delivered in one place and then gets distributed, right?
I don't know. Is that even how it works? I'm not too familiar with that.
Because you know how, remember back like when the Z06 first came out and there were some dealers that would actually go to other dealers and go, you're never going to sell your Z06s. Why don't you give me your allotment? And they would be like, we've got more Z06s than anybody. There was one here in town that used to do that. And that's how they did it. Because there's some dealers, they just don't sell Corvettes. That's not their customer.
Yeah.
And so they would get a bunch of them, and they would have them all on the lot. Maybe it's something like that. But they said one of the cars that was stolen was a Hellcat Charger wide body 50th anniversary car, like super rare. I'd never even heard of it. And gone.
Yeah, I think Goldberg's got one of those. Like, I just drove the Charger wide body, and it was fun. But I think he's got.
Wait a minute, where did he get that?
The 50th anniversary.
He just get it?
Just showed up.
I don't know, but when he took a picture of it, it was next to a container. So who knows?
It was coming in on a truck from the Bay Area, but
actually, it was funny because it showed up right around the same time as his black Dodge Demon. You know, he bought two Demons. He bought the F11 green, and he bought a black one that he didn't drive. It was a time capsule car, but he brought it to Saudi Arabia to that Riyadh show.
Right.
And it was going up for auction. And it was such a shit show, that event, that it took months to get the car back.
Oh, yeah. I don't even remember what that show was like. Back for months.
That car, I don't know, that show was last year sometime, the end of last year.
It was in
December,
November, and they were getting their cars back in like February, March.
I mean, yeah, no, he got his car back like last month, like in April.
My God.
And he photographed it with the charter. He's like, oh, I just went and picked up both my cars, the one that's been sitting in customs or whatever, and the one that was just delivered.
Yeah, you know, we never did a follow-up on how that show went, the one in Abu Dhabi or something.
Yeah.
Not Abu Dhabi. It was in Riyadh, but
Riyadh.
Saudi
sorry,
Arabia.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like I totally forgot about that whole thing after SEMA. They were kind of soliciting, you know, our buddies to say like, "Hey, we'll send you over there," you know.
And
I'd love to do a follow up on that because
situation. Goldberg and I spoke a little bit about it because he went to the event and. Like we said, brought a car to sell. He said that, you know, the people there were great. They were very enthusiastic about the event. A lot of them brought, you know, sort of their own car, sort of a cars and coffee type of event. But the auction
cars
wasn't successful
at all. Saudi Arabia. Come on over.
Yeah. The auction wasn't successful at all because there's – that, like, the royalty or whatever that's there has money and nobody else really does. So it was a big car show, but nobody had the ability to buy anything. And they were trying to do some crazy deals. Like some of the racing cars, the non-street legal cars that were there, whatever royal family or person was in charge gave a waiver. He's like, if you buy any car at this auction, you get like lifetime street legality with whatever you buy. You could just buy straight up dragster if it's here and drive it on the street and you get a pass. Like they were just doing everything they can to sell the cars. Nothing sold. And as far as like moving around a lot of the VIPs and the celebrities, there was a lot of confusion about that. Oftentimes it did feel a little awkward, disorganized, a little bit unsafe. Not necessarily for Goldberg because he's 6'4 and 260 pounds, but but when he's walking around with, you know, with Christy Lee or something, and she's like, I don't have my escort. I don't know who my escort is. And he's like, well, I'll be your escort. And she's like, okay. put her in a backpack and he'll just walk her out. She'll bunk her head out. And he said that he doesn't feel like he would do it again without some real significant changes. Like they have some growing pains. It was a first time event. They would have to work out quite a few things to make it happen again. A significant amount of things. It wasn't just like there wasn't enough bathrooms or the food was terrible. It was like there was a flaw in almost every aspect of it.
It
was what it sounded like.
Basically,
it just needs
what
some
it
work.
was they tried to create an event out of nothing, out of thin air.
Yeah. But big. They had the Hot Wheels loop-de-loop. They had all kinds of stuff there, yeah.
And they have the money. But the problem is there's not a base there. They're trying to create a middle class in Saudi Arabia to keep their country sustained and growing as oil goes down and they don't sell as much. They need to do something. But it's not there. I mean, you know, I've mentioned before, I've done business in the watch industry there. And just what you said, Matt, is there is a higher level of people. They have the discretionary income. They have money. Nobody else does. There's right. nothing below it. That's it. And the other problem with it was that a lot of the, like we were asked if we wanted to come over and do like a Bond Speed Wheel booth and do some appearances and stuff. But we passed for other reasons, and I'm glad we did because a lot of the people, their booths didn't show up till like a week after the show.
Yeah.
So it was and then on our side of things, not meaning us, but the people that went over, a lot of the people that did send their cars over to be sold at the auction put ridiculous prices on it because their vision of it was, oh, it's Saudi Arabia. Some oil-rich prince is going to pay whatever just because he wants my such-and-such car. And that was part of it. Plus, there weren't enough buyers, high prices, and,
ridiculous expectations and an event that was probably a little too big for a freshman event. But, I mean, I like the idea of trying to do
cool.
it. Unfortunately, for us over here as well, myself and Adam Krolla, we passed on it as well. We had several discussions about it. And really for us, it just came down to a timing thing. The amount of time to get on a plane and fly there and do the stuff and come back, especially for Adam, it was going to be over a week of stuff and just trying to be able to bank other shows and do stuff on the road just didn't make much sense. We'd have to bring other producers and stuff. It would have been really expensive.
It was 10 days out of pocket immediately following the SEMA show.
And just
right
before
into the
PRI.
What?
And it was like just before PRI.
Yeah. It was really tough. It was, but anyways, that was that. Hey, did you guys see over the weekend, one of the things that relates to cars and all the unrest, but I was watching some of this coverage of looting and noticed that these looters got pretty nice cars. I saw one group of guys, a guy's filming them. They pull up to a Sprint store, bash open the thing, and then three other cars pulled up. Like the guy called them and three other cars pulled up and they cleared the place out. One of them was a Maserati. One of them was a brand new Escalade. And the other one was like a BMW. And I'm going, no, wait a minute.
Well, but they just picked them up from the Dodge dealer, right?
Yeah, right. They're in the used car park. But I was like, going, yeah, these guys, they're doing all right. But it's weird. Crazy times. It's crazy times.
Yeah.
We all know that. That's why we kind of want to slow it back down. And Matt and I and Aaron have been talking about, maybe – looking at some other things. We all know that that every motorsports event is timed, right, guys? Whether it's Bonneville, drag racing, Formula One, IndyCar, you name it. Even when you get into other things like drifting and like that, there's a time that you – and so timing and cars have always gone together. I mean, you guys know that is exactly why – one of the reasons I started my watch companies because of the fact that timing and the automobile and the aesthetics. I always told people that the reason men buy watches is because first it's the aesthetics, what the watch looks like. Then if they're really getting into it and they're an enthusiast, just like a car, you would lift the hood and go, what's the power plant? Enthusiasts in the watch industry, they get into it asking what's the movement, how was it made, where was it made, all the same things that we talk about. And so Matt took that another step and has started reaching out. And, we're talking about bringing some guests in because if you guys have ever invested in cars and you've ever thought about watches, why not give you a little bit more street cred and a little bit more information to draw on? And not just about my watches, but everybody's watches. And Matt, tell them what a little bit about our guests we're going to have today.
Yeah. So the intention here was because of Brad's background in the watch industry and a lot of the crossover between watches and cars as a collector, as what people are into.
We wanted
from a mechanical standpoint, from an artistic standpoint, from a collectability standpoint, we wanted to just sort of test the waters with you guys, the listeners, on a very high level and just say, are you interested in watches? What kind of watches are you interested in? And if we had a few conversations about what to collect and what's kind of cool and what's, maybe what to avoid, some things like that, just sort of like an introduction to watch collecting, if you guys would like that or not. So not something we do on every show. Maybe something we hit maybe once a month if you're interested. So definitely give us some feedback on that. But that being said, we have a guest coming in pretty soon. A friend named Ariel Adams, and he runs a website called A Blog to Watch. He was the original creator of the first blog for watches back in 2007. He's been a contributor for Forbes, and he's sort of the authoritative when it comes to watch collecting, buying, selling, you know, buying guides, things like that, without aligning himself to any particular brand. He is sort of the auto blog or Jalopnik of the watch industry. And so he'll be joining us in a few minutes, and we can hit him up with a few questions and see what you guys think. But
yeah, because it's so interesting, because a lot of my friends and your friends who are car collectors have this fantastic watch collection. I mean, I could say almost everybody I know who's got more than maybe two really nice, you know, collectible cars, at least in the, you know, Ferrari and Porsche league, you know, they've got this amazing collection of watches, and I've always admired it, because there's some really cool watches. I was just down at Fur Parts with my son last week, having some fun, and mm-hmm. And Russ showed us that one of his clients gave him one of those really high end, you know, Ferrari watches, the one that looks like a motor, you know, and my other friend Matt, who's got a bunch of Ferraris, he's got all these fancy watches. And then, of course, you know, our friend Ferrari collector David Lee, it sells watches, high end watches.
Yeah, yeah.
There is a correlation, that there is a relationship between that, and it's always fascinated me what it is. I like watches. I just can't afford those types of watches, so I just stay away. But there's, Brad, there's some beautiful stuff out there.
The thing about it, though, you hit it on the head, is that you're talking about exotics. Okay, if we put it in the realm of cars. There is, yeah,
it is more of an exotic
there
thing,
is the exotic guys that, you know, whether, you know, if you take what you were just talking about and a late model Ferrari, a late model Bugatti, a late model whatever, but there is a way to get into watch collecting on any level. And when I first got into watch collecting, it wasn't, you know, that, oh, I'm going to make a company, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, or buy super high-end watches. I got into them because I really appreciated the machined aspect, the style, mm-hmm. the design, the aesthetics. Yeah. And then I learned more about it as I went. The thing is that any guy, I don't care who it is, if they got a little bit of discretionary income, you can go after some of the watches that were American made in the 50s and in the 40s and in the mm-hmm. 20s. And like, I have watches in my collection that they get so much conversation just because of what they are, not because they're super, super high quality or anything like that. And some of them are high quality, but like, I have a watch in my collection, Aaron, that looks like the radiator from a 1929 Ford.
Oh, wow.
It says Ford on it. And it has a bracelet, a link bracelet. And as far as the movement, it's a cheap movement inside. And it was stamped out and it was chrome plated. Nothing fancy there. But when you turn it over, what's so cool is it says a guy's name. I can't remember it right now, but it says awarded to so-and-so for having the most car sales in America, 1929. And Ford awarded it to this guy. And somewhere through the years, it made it from hand to hand, and now it's in my collection. And I was wearing it one time, and Herb Fischel, who was the head of all GM's motorsports back in the 90s, he went, "Where did you get that?" And I told him I bought it from a collection, and he goes, "I've only seen one other one of those, and it's at the museum." And he said they used to actually hand them out every year to the regional guys who won. So that's the kind of stuff that you can still find.
Yeah.
And then on a more quality aspect, I have some watches that are made out of solid gold ingot, and they're called jump hours, where you guys have probably seen them, where instead of having hands, you have one disc that gives you the hour and another disc that gives you the seconds. So it'll say like 2 and then below it, 33. And they rotate, and they came in a lot of different styles. There's one that I have that looks like a golf ball. It's a perforated, but one that is like square, and it's really cool looking. And there's all these famous photos of Elvis Presley. They were his favorite watches, and they were made in America. And you can get a watch like that for under $500. Well, now that gold's gone up, I take that back. They probably are more, but still under $1,000, because there wasn't like, you know, it wasn't a full ounce of gold.
Right? Yeah. Let's go back to when you were the top Ford salesman in 1929.
Yes, that's, yeah, I know. I was pre-selling Fox bodies.
But it's so interesting because, you know, we all grew up with that cliche of, oh, you know, I retire and I get my gold watch, you know, and it's like, do watches, I mean, they obviously do still have that prestige, but do they still have that prestige with the blue collar worker, with the corporate guy that get the gold watch when I retire, you know, do they still have that kind of thing? I have my grandpa's watch when he finished, you know, and retired. Mm-hmm. And I have his watch from the war. And I have like an old World War II pocket watch. I used to love pocket watches. And I have my grandfather's old pocket watch, two of my old grandfather's pocket watches as well. But I've never been a big watch collector, but it's always kind of fascinated me. It's always been that thing rattling in the back of my mind. And yeah, now, you know, we see it in kind of, like you said, Brett, the exotic world. I'm really curious to hear what this Ariel has to say. That's very cool.
I think one of the things, and Matt and I have talked about this, is that you can take an older car and you can put an LS in it, but there's some cars that you really just want to stick with that drive
train,
flathead
V8.
And that is what we're talking about in the watch world. For racing now, they use digital timing because it's so much accurate. They can get it down to a point decimal. But when you look back, doesn't it just kind of give you kind of a good feeling when you look back? I see our guest is here. Doesn't it make you look back when you see like these old time trials and they got a clipboard with three of the big stopwatches and the bar so they could hit it all at the same time to verify they had the right one?
I've got two in my Triumph TR3 rally car. So
yeah,
so yeah,
they used to have
totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to bring Ariel
different.
In.
Yeah.
There's Ariel.
It's an interesting.
We were just talking about you.
Welcome. How are you?
Hey everyone. Ariel Adams here. How you doing?
Doing all right. We were just talking about you, doing a nice little introduction and giving a few of our watch stories as we sort of introduce this. And one of the ones I was finishing up with these guys is I also have my grandfather's watch that was his retirement gift, I guess, when he retired from Grumman, and he served in World War II and he made planes. And then it was a time where he was working at Grumman building planes. And then when he had to go to war, the wives would go in then and work in the factory and take their place. And I have his watch. And an interesting thing about it is, the battery in that watch, he never wore it really. So the battery in that watch has been dead for so long that when I took it in to see if I can get it fixed, the guy said, hey, he goes, I this would take probably a little more work to get it going than it's probably worth right now. So it depends on if you're going to wear it or not. But he said, but because that battery's been dead for so long, all the components on the inside, there's no wear on them. Like it was never moving. So everything is just sort of well preserved. So I'm like, well, I guess the watch is probably better as a collectible piece without it working right now than it would be with it working. So kind of a weird story. It'd be like, hey, I've got this really nice collector car and yeah, we want to keep the miles low, but let's just never run the engine because it'll last longer that way. I don't know, but that's not good for a car.
So yeah, is it good for a watch?
Well, I guess you could call it a time capsule.
Yeah, Brad.
Just like a car, if you don't move the gears and things in a watch, the oils will congeal. And so it depends on how the movement is made. But it's true that if you have a watch for a very long time, you should start the movement every once in a while. Otherwise, a watchmaker is going to have to rebuild it from scratch, which can happen.
That's kind of interesting. Maybe I'll look into what it's going to take to get that thing going at some point.
I wouldn't touch it.
Guys, because we're going to run out of time, and I want to give Ariel all the time we can. So
Ariel, one of the things I wanted to touch on real quick was my first question is well, I have sort of two questions I want to hit because we've only got about 10 minutes. But one is, why do car guys like watches? And we started getting on that a little bit, sort of the collectability. And I'm not saying watches need to be more expensive than cars. A lot of them are, but they all don't have to be expensive. But also, there are a number of watch brands that are associated with cars. We have something like Hublot and Ferrari's partnership. Are those Ferrari watches more collectible? But then we have like Porsche Design that seems to make their own watches. And are they more collectible? So yeah, why do car guys like watches? Let's start with that.
Okay, so this discussion could go like 10 minutes, 50 times over. There's so much to talk about. And I love cars. I'm a car guy. I was a car guy before I was a watch guy. So I started reading car magazines since I was like 12 or 13 years old before I could drive. So I'm kind of in both seats, right? And one of the things that car guys and watch guys share in common is an appreciation of well-made, purpose-built tools and the enjoyment of using them. And one of the interesting differences between watches and cars is still a pursuit that's more democratic. Everyone knows what it feels like, or most people knows what it feels like to drive a good car. And so generally speaking, people understand how to appreciate the difference between a good car and a not-so-great car. With watches, that's sort of a lost art, because over the last 30 years, we have a lot of quartz watches and they all perform exactly the same. So circa like 1960, two different watches operated different. One was accurate, one wasn't, one was easy to use, one was hard to read. And so people had a better appreciation for how to know the difference between a good watch and a bad watch because they relied upon them more, similar with cars. And I think to myself, in the future, when most people are driving around in autonomous cars, there's going to be only a few enthusiasts that have access to private tracks. They can still drive themselves. That might be where the car industry is heading, similar to with watches, where there's this, a lot of people know what they are, but there's only this core group of people that really understand them. There's a brand called Richard Mille, super high-end, million-dollar watches most of the time, and they liken their watches to a race car on your wrist. The idea is that if you love a supercar, this is a supercar for the wrist that you can take with you, off the street, into the club, into the restaurant, and things like that. So a lot of times today, a watch is sort of a portable, stylized version of expressing a similar thing about the person than their car would. As you know, the cars people like, they make a very distinct message about who that person is, why you like that color, why you like that brand, why you like that style. And so in addition to appreciating the mechanics, the expressive nature, I think, is very powerful for guys like us.
Wow, yeah. Very fantastic.
I think the other thing, too, is that we've always, with my brand, we've always talked about the fact that guys appreciate the aesthetics of a nice car and the aesthetics of a nice watch. And as I was telling them earlier, it's
in a car, you,
yeah, you lift the hood and want to know the drivetrain. That's the enthusiast in the automotive world. But in the next thing is, does it have a glass back? Can I see the movement? Are the bridges hot rodded? Is there any kind of decoration? And what have they done to it? And that's where you separate the enthusiast. And what we've always seen is that when I go to Europe or I go to Asia or some of the Middle Eastern countries, people have a much higher appreciation for timepieces because many of them don't ever own a house. Some of them don't own a car, but they have a very nice watch and they know more about it. And when they purchase, wouldn't you agree? They purchase first for the quality, the movement, the aesthetics. The very final thing is the brand, where in the US, it's the opposite. It's the brand for the average guy, the brand. And then they go from there. Then they learn about it after they buy it.
You make a lot of really great points because here in the United States, us as guys have a lot more things that we can get more easily. Like you said, homes and things like that. In Hong Kong, for example, or Japan, you can have about 100 of these in a little space. You might not even be able to have one single car, right? And
right.
So the marketing in a lot of places, the world's a lot more strong. in America, watch appreciation, it's not that we've never had it. It's actually lost art. Towards the turn of the 20th century, America was the most important market in the world, not just for buying watches, but for making watches. We beat the Swiss, and then later, through the 20th century, we decided it's too expensive to make in America. Let's start outsourcing and things like that. So our sort of native appreciation for watches went away. And still in America, we still make a lot of cars, right? And so you still have a lot of sort of endemic understanding of the machine, whereas in America, you know, we still have brands like Timex, for example. But they, until recently, they haven't even made any watches in America since for years and years and years. And so you're right. In other parts of the world, for guys like you and me that travel a lot, we'll go to places like Asia and be like, oh my gosh, I didn't even know watches were a thing. And a lot of American men that I meet did not pick up an appreciation for watches until they started traveling. While, you know, I'm from Los Angeles, you grow up in a car culture. It's from the time you're very, very young.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is that when I first started going to Switzerland, and you guys, sorry I'm boring you, you've heard this before, but
I
have a large collection of U.S. watches, you know, Elgins and things like that. And that's how I started. And I would wear a different watch every time I went to my factory in Switzerland. And they were just enamored because they'd never seen them. And they were just, oh, I want to see this one. What's the history on this one? And it's that appreciation that for the timepiece, rather than, you know, oh, does it have a tourbillon, you know, movement or something like this, you know?
Yeah, well, I have a question. Oh, go ahead.
Oh no, I don't want to change the stream of thought. Go.
I wanted to show off before we ran out of time. I have four sort of automotive themed watches of completely different styles, and some of them go to what we talk about. And I just thought it might help the audience understand some of the variety, because the car watch crossovers, of which there have been so many, come in a lot of different flavors. So somebody mentioned Porsche design.
Yeah.
Okay. So Porsche design, for the last several years, they've changed recently, was very shy to tell everyone we're related to Porsche Automotive. And then recently they're like, of course we have to mention this. So this is a Porsche design watch that comes from a company that also designs cars. This was called the Flat Six. So obviously there's a relationship to the car culture. This is one that was from a few years ago, but that's one flavor. So there's various types of watches out there that come. Obviously, Porsche Design is its own company, but it's part of the, you know, the bigger Volkswagen group and Porsche Design and Porsche in general. So that's one flavor, and I got a few of these. This is a little bit more niche. This is a much more rare watch. This is actually still new. There's a F1 automotive illustrator named Giorgio Piallo, and he just decided to make a line of watches, right? So this one has like a brake rotor bezel and, you know, some pushers there on the side that look like start stop for, you know, various types of Ferraris, and the colors and things like that look F1. So this is someone that says, I love the world of F1 and I want to sort of design elements of it into a watch. So that's another flavor.
And I hate to even say this, we got less than a minute.
Okay. This is a Jaguar watch done with Bremont. So this is an official one done with a car company. I actually helped launch this with them at Galpin at Jaguar. And then this is a Gallet chronograph. This would be sort of a racer's chronograph. This is not designed with cars in mind, but this is the type of product that people, before they had digital timers, would use to time races and the speeds of cars and things like that. So up until about 1970, 1980, chronographs like this were used widely on the track. And so you have watches meant to go with cars and watches meant to look like cars.
Ariel, I apologize. We're going to run out of time. So I want to plug
back on.
A blog to watch.
The whole show.
A blog to watch. And we will have you back on very soon, because we integrated you into the show a little too late. We need you to come in earlier. Yeah.
No problem.
Much to discuss.
Yeah. It's it's so interesting, because there is such a link between the automotive, the timing. I mean, you can see behind me that photo right there, Bonneville Salt Flats. They're looking at a watch. So, everybody, thanks.
Let us
know on our social media what you think about watches and cars, because we'll integrate more of it. Ariel, thank you so much.
We'll do this again.
Is there anything other than a black watch we need to do real quick for you? All right, guys, thank you so much. Shift and stare, and we'll be back next week and watch the video portion on our Facebook page.
If you like this show, also listen to Man Seeks Adventure and
Dixon's Wild Ride. You can find Man Seeks Adventure at manseeksadventure.com.